This is a CBC podcast. Enjoy Canada's opera, pop, jazz, and rock, all recorded live by CBC Radio. The Concerts On Demand website is your source for the best in Canadian concerts. Head to cbc.ca/radio2 and follow the link to Concerts On Demand.
From the PWN's Centennial Concert Hall in Winkler, Manitoba, it's the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, we have been on the road for a month now. Began in northern Alberta, in Grand Prairie, Alberta, to be precise, at a theater designed by the great Canadian Aboriginal architect Douglas Cardinal. The theater and the college that houses it is made of red brick, but it's a brick that seems to defy clay, brick that rolls like the prairie wind, all round, all full of curving light and softness. From there, we rolled even further north. Northwest first, to Dawson Creek, British Columbia, where we hopped on the Alaska Highway at mile one and rolled our way to Fort St. John. Since then, we followed lots of roads and lots of rivers. We rolled along the banks of the Peace River more than once, and we stood 8,000 feet above sea level in Banff, Alberta, where the only rivers are rivers of snow. We've walked the beautiful downtown trails of Red Deer. And, of course, we stopped, as we always do when we're rolling around the West, for a cinnamon roll at Ann and Karsten Curra's ever-expanding bakery in Maple Creek, Saskatchewan. We've been on the road for almost a month, and during that month, we've been here, there, and everywhere. We have had, as usual, our share of adventures making our way here. But here we are, finally, here at our last stop on this tour of Western Canada in Winkler, Manitoba. I don't know why it took us so long to get here. Everyone else seems to have made it here before us. Winkler's a town of 9,000 people from 34 different nations. Town where a third of the high school students were born outside Canada. A town where the unemployment rate is, are you ready for this? Zero. And that's more impressive than you think, because Winkler's a prairie town. And when the railway and farming economy were overtaken by oil and the automobile, many similar towns died, not Winkler. Winkler, remarkably, has prospered. People have differing opinions as to why this is. Some say it's the low tax rate. Some say it's generations of good city planning. Others say it's the price of real estate. But everyone seems to agree that the work ethic has something to do with it. It's a hard-working town, people have told me, and it's a town of faith. In his history of Winkler, Dr. Hans Werner wrote, "The decisions made by the community about what constituted appropriate behavior, the nature of disagreement, and the language that accompanied inevitable conflict were informed by understandings of what it meant to be a Christian, and most often, a Mennonite Christian." I was thinking about that when I read this letter to the editor online in the Winkler Times a couple of weeks ago. The headline read, "Other driver was right, and I was wrong." Here's the letter. "Dear editor, on February 26th, during the lunchtime, I was approaching Highway 32 from Pembina Avenue East. When the highway cleared, I proceeded to turn left onto Highway 32. In the meantime, you had approached the same intersection from Pembina Avenue West. As I turned, I drove right in front of you with my pickup truck. You were driving a beige minivan, I think. And you had the right of way, and I was wrong. I am sorry. That, apparently, is the kind of town this is. Town of hard-working people who have prospered. Town with faith and the best of what faith has to offer. The ability to see right from wrong. And this is where things often get messed up. The ability to recognize when you are wrong or have done wrong and to apologize for it. So I'm glad to be here finally. And I'm glad you're here too. We have an hour of stories and music to share together, and I'd like to bring out our first musical guest right now to get things going. Will you please welcome Bob King?
Clean, fresh air, and friendly people all around. My father was a working man, and he said to me one day, if you ever want to impress someone, this is what you say. I was born in Winkler, Manitoba. Winkler, Manitoba, I was born. I blow my horn in Winkler, Manitoba. Winkler is the place I blow my horn. Several interviews, they said, I'm sorry, Bob. I finally found a job for me. It was really quite a plum. And the thing that clinched the job was when they asked where I was from. And I said, I was born in Winkler, Manitoba. Winkler, Manitoba, I was born. I blow my horn in Winkler, Manitoba. Winkler is the place I blow my horn. Time to be looking for a wife. So I looked around to find someone to compliment my life. I finally found a girl for me. She was also quite well-bred. When I asked her where she got such poise, this is what she said. Get to heaven one day, and I know it might sound strange, but since I've lived in Winkler, I can't see there being much change. I know I'll see my neighbors there, sitting on the heavenly porch, and they'll all shout good night as we pass the cabbage borscht, and we'll sing night.
King with, you guessed it, the Winkler Manitoba song. And playing with him were John Shear, Dennis Pendrith, and Rebecca and Matthew Harder of the band House of Dock. And the Winkler song, that Winkler song is on Bob King's album, How the West Was Fun. So I was taken to Topper's Restaurant on Main Street today. I went for one of those traditional low-fat, low-carb Mennonite lunches. Now, this is a farming community, so the parking lot was full of pickups. Inside, it was packed. All the booths, all the tables were full. The men were wearing their caps while they ate. Some of the women had their heads covered with the old-style dioks. I had Veronica with schmuntfat, five large cheese-stuffed pierogies floating in a pool of brown gravy, side of farmer's sausage, a mountain of sour cream, a zwieback with butter. Now, I don't know much about the Mennonite faith, but I know this. If I ate like that every day, I'd be praying too. When I finished my meal, I slid around the restaurant and talked to some of the people. You see, I didn't even know that part was funny. But you guys know more about that food than I do. I made my way around the restaurant, slowly, talked to some of the people at the tables around me. Mostly I was interested in matters of faith. Everyone I talked to told me they spent time every day in what they call devotional activities, in prayer and reading scriptures. Wouldn't be like that in any of the restaurants where I live. Everything still closes here on Sundays, said Robert. Even the Walmart and the superstores. When people pray here, they expect their prayers to be answered. I try to live a life of discipleship, said Linda. She was sitting two tables over. I try to make sure my daily life is informed by my faith, to live the will of God as I understand it. When I asked Linda what that meant to her, she sat silently for almost a minute. She finally said one word, pacifism. It was Lord Simcoe's Militia Act of 1793 that first provided protection in Canada to men and women who objected to compulsory military service. I didn't know that. And I found it both reassuring and disturbing to learn that religious tolerance and political enlightenment reached that far back. Reassuring that they had come that far 200 years ago. Disturbing that we haven't come much further. Linda put her mug of coffee down and looked directly into my eyes. Then she dropped her head and said, I just can't see how violence is an acceptable response to another human, to someone who was created in the image of God. There are many different understandings of what it means to be a Mennonite. There are religious Mennonites and cultural Mennonites. There are old orders and new orders. During World War II, many young Mennonite men took conscientious status, but many also served. There's a joke about the Mennonite who was rescued from the desert island. He'd built three huts. What are those for? Asked his rescuers. Well, he said, pointing at the first one, that one's where I live. And the second one, they asked? Well, he said, that's where I go to church. Well, what about that one, they asked, pointing at the third hut. Oh, he said, that's where I used to go to church. There are lots of churches in this town. Over 25, I'm told. Someone told me that there are more churches per capita in Winkler than anywhere else in Manitoba. People here tell you they pray for you, said Maria, who was finishing a piece of pie with her friend Margaret. It's true, she said. You can feel it. John Sheard's going to play the piano for you now. John Sheard. Time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, if you listen to the show regularly, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories and they have to be short, but after that, they don't have to be anything at all. It's up to you. We read everything you send us, and we read some of our favorites on the radio show. We have one today from Ellie Reimer of Winkler, Manitoba. Dear Stuart, writes Ellie, I've long wanted to write and tell you about the Money Man. The Money Man was not his real name, and for all I know, my son was the only person here in Winkler, the only person in the world, in fact, to call him that. It was not a nickname that would have sprung to mind when you saw him, and for good reason. The Money Man had scruffy salt and pepper whiskers that sprouted on his wrinkled, weather-beaten face. His red eyes squinted as though he needed glasses. His unkempt hair matched his messy beard. He wore flannel shirts, summer and winter, and heavy, baggy woolen pants held up with frayed suspenders. His ripped pant seams were sewn together unevenly with huge stitches of white string. He wore scuffed bedroom slippers on his feet. He was the closest thing Winkler had to a hobo, at least in the years after the war. But my son called him the Money Man. This is how it happened. Every time we went downtown for groceries, I'd try to forestall my two-year-old's begging for a treat by stopping at the gumball machine at the store's entrance and buying him a gumball. One day, before I could get out my penny, a wrinkled hand reached out and put a penny into my son's hand. I looked behind me and saw this man, his face lit up with a toothless grin. So began our tradition. We came shopping. He gave my son a penny for his treat. No words, just a gentle, tentative smile, a twinkle in his eyes, and a coin. If he didn't have a penny, he'd offer a nickel. After a while, my son came to look forward to the little transaction. As soon as he saw the man, he would shout, "The Money Man!" And he'd run towards his friend with his hands outstretched. The Money Man would beam with pride and shakily extract a coin from his pocket. But like little Jackie Paper in Puff the Magic Dragon, one day, my son came no more. He'd started kindergarten. The first time I went shopping without him, the Money Man shuffled over to me and said, shyly, "Where's the boy?" I can still see the look of disappointment on his face when I told him his little buddy was in school. He looked as if he had lost his best friend. Maybe he had. Certainly he had lost the only person to whom he was the Money Man. The Money Man has long since gone to his reward. And I hope there's at least one little cherub there who goes running to him regularly with hands outstretched, whooping, "Look, it's the Money Man." That story came to us from Ellie Reimer of Winkler, Manitoba, and she's here tonight. Put up the house lights so Ellie can stand up. Where are you, Ellie? There she is in the front row. That was very nice. Thank you. Well, I'd like to introduce our next musical guest now. If you listen to the show on the radio, you'll know that one of the things that we try to do on the Vinyl Cafe is shine the light on young Canadian musicians, on people we think deserve a bit of attention, people who might not otherwise have the light shone upon them. I first ran into our next musical act for the first time about 5 years ago. I was biking along Queen Street in Toronto on an autumn afternoon, and they were standing on the corner of Queen and John, just up from the CBC, busking for spare change. Since that afternoon, they have recorded three albums and toured the country a number of times in support of them. And I've been waiting patiently for the day that I could come to Winkler and say, ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome to the Vinyl Cafe, Dalla.
So I'm Sheila.
I'm Amanda.
And we met back in our Catholic high school band class. And we're going to play you a song off our new album, which is, I guess, based on a lot of the questions and the kind of the conflicts you go through in your teenage years. And it's called Sunday Dress.
You're asking all the questions I get at the border. I know you wanna file me away with the girls who disappoint you every day. No better staring at your mouth, making all the plans as the words come out. It's hard to choose in a
Dalla! That's from Dallas' brand new album. It's called Who Do You Think You Are? There's no good time for bad news. Something bad happens, people often say it couldn't have come at a worse time. But there's no better time when the news that comes is not the news you want. Bad news always has bad timing. Stephanie's boyfriend, Tommy, hung up the phone and walked into the bathroom and stared at himself in the bathroom mirror. He stood there staring for the longest time. When he was finished staring, he went into his bedroom and picked his green hoodie off the floor. His toque was on top of the fridge. He fetched his toque, grabbed his notebook from the couch, and he headed out, hands in his pocket, shoulders hunched. He didn't know it, but he was going to see Steph. He didn't go right there, though. He walked around for a good hour before he realized that's where he was going. Steph was in her kitchen when he got there, by the stove, to be precise, holding a handful of pasta over a big pot. She was wearing an apron that said, "Procrastinate now." Tommy knocked on the window in the kitchen door and let himself in. She was surprised to see him. He had told her that he was going to stay home and write. Steph said, "What are you doing here?" And right out of the blue, just like he had appeared, just like the phone call, Tommy said, "My grandpa died." Steph ran across the kitchen and gave him a hug. She said, "Are you okay?" Tommy dropped his canvas bag by the table. Tommy said, "I totally don't believe it." The first time Tommy took Stephanie to meet his grandpa, it was his birthday, a family dinner. And it was a deal that he took her. He'd never taken anyone before, especially not a girl. She was nervous. She had talked way too much. But his grandpa liked her. He had sat with her after dinner and talked to her about the war. Tommy said he was at the barber's. He had a stroke. They didn't even take him to the hospital. Ink. That's what Tommy was thinking about. His grandfather was plagued by ink. Ink on his fingers, ink on his shirt. He dies and all Tommy can think about is what was going to happen to his grandpa's pens. Steffi said, "I was thinking about them too. Anyone would think about that. That would come to anyone's mind." He was ink stained. Tommy's grandfather was the only person Stephanie knew who used a fountain pen. He had a collection of pens that he kept in a wooden box on his desk. "This one's a Parker 51, he said, holding up a sleek gray pen with a hooded nib. "This is my Waterman." He took a glass bottle of ink out of the drawer and unscrewed it. Then he sniffed it. "You have to be careful," he said, looking at her over his glasses. "Ink can go bad." He took an eyedropper and used the eyedropper to fill the Waterman. When he finished, there was a smudge of ink on his forehead. He handed her the pen. His initials were engraved on the gold clip. He got a piece of paper out and laid it on the desk. "You have to break a pen like this in," he said. "The paper wears the nib down for just the way you write. It's a gold nib." Stephanie looked at him and he nodded. "Go on," he said. So she sat down and she wrote her name in real ink. "Imagine," he said, "paper wearing down gold. It's like that kid's game. You probably write with a safety pen." "The ballpoint," said Stephanie. "Ah," he said, "you might as well write with a nail." He gave her one of his pens. It was tortoise shell with gold inlay. The first thing she wrote was a letter to him. "Thank you." She sniffed the ink every time she filled it. She had no idea what bad ink smelt like. And now she never would. It was a Waterman. Lewis J. Waterman was an insurance man. So was Tommy's grandfather. Waterman got messed up in the pen business after a leaky pen messed up one of his contracts. Tommy's grandfather, who was also Lewis, didn't go anywhere without his Waterman. Tommy stayed at Stephanie's for dinner that night. It was while they were doing the dishes that Stephanie said, "Hey, what's going to happen to the ticket?" Tommy said, "I hadn't thought about that." His grandfather's famous lottery ticket. He'd owned it for 10 years. "Longer," said Tommy, "longer for sure. I remember from when I was a kid." There were different stories. He'd bought it after he'd touched a bride. He bought it the day he found a four-leaf clover. He bought it with 100 pennies that he'd found heads up. Tommy and Stephanie were sitting on her couch. Stephanie said, I don't think he really believed that stuff. Tommy said, I asked him about the pennies once. I mean, he had this whole routine with pennies he found, right? If they were heads up, he kept them and made a wish. If they were heads down, he'd give them away. Because heads down meant bad luck, so he had to give them away heads up to cancel the bad luck. When I was a kid, if I was with him when he found a penny, he'd give me the wishes. Then he'd make me tell him what I'd wished for. I told him, "You weren't supposed to tell." He said, "You were allowed to tell grandfathers." I asked him when I was older, and he laughed and said he didn't really believe. Stephanie said, "I didn't think so." Then she said, "Weird that you'd still do it anyway, right? Like saying bless you after you sneeze." Tommy said, "He said he did it because he had heard that it still worked, even if you didn't believe." So Tommy's grandfather had this lottery ticket. It was one of those scratch tickets from way back. There's no date on it, not even an expiry date. The prize was $1 million. That's what he used to say. Imagine $1 million. Then he'd say, "What would you do with $1 million? And then you had to tell him what you'd do. And he would listen ever so carefully. And when you were finished, he'd say, "Are you sure that's what you'd do? Is that your heart's desire?" And you had to go through the whole thing all over again. It was all very serious because of the ticket, which he'd never scratched, and which he told everyone with absolute conviction was the winning ticket. Might sound crazy, but he was a very convincing man. So the ticket was a huge deal in the family, and it had been for years. They argued about it at family dinners. They argued about it at Christmas time. "Lewis," shouted his brother, $1 million isn't what it used to be." "Still $1 million, said Lewis. "But if you'd put it in the bank instead of leaving it on the mantle, you would have collected interest. All these years, you know how much you would have had?" "Maybe I'd had nothing," he said. "Tommy, pass your mother the peas. You've read what happens to lottery winners. That man in Niagara Falls, that family in New Brunswick. I still have the million. How much does one man need?" And then he'd gesture toward the ticket, or maybe he'd get up and walk over to the mantle where he kept it in a box, and he would pick it up and wave it in the air. Lewis believed having a dream was better than having a pile of money. Money, well, money could cause no end of problems. "It's way better to stick with dreams," he said. Tommy said, "It used to drive my uncle nuts. My uncle thought he was crazy." Stephanie said, "What do you think?" Tommy said, "I don't know. He was so sure. He was certain. I mean, it could be the winner. You can't deny that. It could be." Steph said, "Do you think you should scratch it?" Tommy said, "Do you think so?" Steph said, "Well, that way you'd know." Tommy said, "Because he's gone, don't you think we should check the will?" She hadn't thought of that. She hadn't thought of what he'd want. "He didn't mention it," said Tommy's father, holding his cell phone in his hand. "Don't you think that's odd?" said Tommy's mother. "What?" said Tommy's father. "That it wasn't mentioned? or that I'm phoning a lawyer to ask him to recheck my father's will to make certain he didn't mention an unscratched lottery ticket that he's had on his mantelpiece for a decade. Yes. Now that you ask, I think it's odd. What would happen, said Stephanie, if you scratched it and it was a winner? I'd feel bad for not trusting him, said Tommy, for not believing. And if it wasn't a winner, well, then I'd just feel bad. The funeral was scheduled for Monday. Tommy went home on Thursday. And by the time he got there, the whole neighborhood was buzzing. No one had a say, but everyone had an opinion. Wherever Tommy went, they were talking about the ticket, and they all wanted to tell him what they thought. They were talking about it at the funeral parlor. Tommy, the reason he didn't mention it in the will is because he knew it wasn't a winner. He knew it was worthless. You should just scratch it and be done with it. They were talking about it at the corner store. Ahmed, if you're so sure that it's not a winning ticket, why are you in such a hurry for the boy to scratch it? If you're so sure, you should just tell him to throw it out. And they were talking about it at the barber shop, the very place where Lewis had had his stroke. Tommy, I went to your grandpa's house once so he could show it to me. I have a picture. In the picture, I'm holding the ticket. Maybe we could scratch the picture. They were talking about it in front of Tommy, but also behind his back. He could feel it, the way they stopped talking when they saw him. Some were believers. It made him happy, they'd say, and no harm was done. Everyone should have such a thing. Others thought the whole thing was foolish. It's not the original ticket, said one of them. He scratched the original ticket years ago. He won $5. That's all. I know a guy who was there when he did it. It was only $5. The guy told me. The whole neighborhood was divided into two camps. The scratchers and the non-scratchers. The believers and the ones who didn't believe. The night before the funeral, Tommy's family gathered at the house after dinner. Tommy, Tommy's father, and Tommy's great uncle Lawrence were sitting at the dining room table. The ticket was lying on the table between them. Lewis used to torment Uncle Lawrence with the ticket. He'd bring the ticket out at family dinners and lay it in front of him and watch him squirm. Watch him squirm, he'd say. And oh, he'd squirm. Lois, he'd start it. It's arrogant to say that money doesn't matter. Tommy's grandfather didn't have to say much during these conversations. He'd just poke his brother Lawrence now and again if he was running out of steam. It's irresponsible. If you don't want the money, you should use it for something else. Send the grandchildren to university. He said that at Christmas this year. And when he did, Lewis twinkled and he winked at Tommy and he said, but the grandchildren are already at university. Uncle Lawrence said, ah, give it to charity then. And that's when Lewis pounced. Lewis said, ah, now we're talking. Tell me exactly which charity. Come on now, what would you do if you had $1 million? And Uncle Lawrence knew he'd been suckered in again. And he slapped the table, and that was the end of that. It's not about the money, said Uncle Lawrence for the fourth time that night. I don't want the money. It's the principle. If it's not about the money, said Tommy's father, then what's the hurry? 10 years we've gone without scratching. We can wait until he's buried? And so it was decided. They would wait until after the funeral. And after the funeral, when everyone was together, they would scratch the ticket. Everyone had an opinion, all right. Even the Reverend Sims, who everyone agreed spoke so nicely at the service, appeared to have weighed in. Lewis was a man of faith. And faith is the ability to believe in something that cannot be proven. What is he talking about? It's Uncle Lawrence. We scratch and we know. It's as simple as that. There's the proof. Be quiet, you old goat. Lawrence's wife. He isn't talking about the ticket. Show some respect for your dead brother. Hocus pocus, muttered Uncle Lawrence. Back at the house after the service, there was a lot of discussion about what the Reverend Sims had meant. What he's saying, said Tommy's father, is if you believe you know, then you know. That's what faith is. Tommy's head was spinning. If you were among the faithful then, you believed that scratching the ticket would be a loss of faith. Lewis had faith. He didn't need to scratch the ticket. Uncle Lawrence was sitting in his brother Lewis's favorite chair. He had a coffee cup perched precariously on the arm. Lawrence, said Tommy's father, owning the ticket gave him hope. Maybe he needed hope more than he needed money. Hope, said Uncle Lawrence. Hope is false and foolish. All he had was false hope. Hope, said Tommy's father, keeps despair at bay. Not mine, said Uncle Lawrence. I despair that I'm living in a family of idiots. There were seven people around the table on Tuesday night. Tommy, Tommy's mother, Tommy's father, Uncle Lawrence, Lawrence's wife Muriel, his Aunt Edith, and Edith's son, Tony. Tony was the youngest. It was Tony's job to go to the mantle and get the box with the ticket. Tony got up from the dining room table and walked to the mantle. He carried the wooden box carefully across the room and placed it in front of Uncle Lawrence, who was the oldest. Tommy was sitting opposite Uncle Lawrence. Tommy squeezed his eyes closed as Uncle Lawrence opened the box. Uncle Lawrence looked into the box and then slowly around the table. Then he picked the box up and held it so everyone could see in. Lewis's faded lottery ticket was gone. There were seven brand new tickets in its place. And so a week passed, and Tommy and Stephanie were back at her apartment. Tommy said, it was only a week ago. Tommy was sitting at the table where he had sat that night. He was drinking a coffee. Stephanie said, I wish I could have been there when you told them. Tommy said, my father laughed. No one else said anything. What could they say? The ticket was buried. I put the ticket in Grandpa's pocket. They weren't going to dig him up. Tommy stumbled on the word buried, and then he started to cry. Whoa, he said. That took a while. It's okay, said Stephanie. It's about time. And she waited. And when he was finished, she said, I wish I could have seen your Uncle Lawrence. I wish you had a video. Yeah, said Tommy, he surprised me. I thought he was going to scratch the new ticket right away, like to make a point. No one did. Then she said, why did you do it? Because, said Tommy, I trusted him. Staffy said, I think he would have liked you to have it. Tommy said, the money? Steffi said, not the money. The dream. And Tommy said, I do. And he reached into his pocket and he pulled out his ticket. I bought seven, he said. Stephanie held out her hand and he handed the ticket to her. Steffi said, do you think it's a winner? And Tommy said, oh, I know it's a winner. I'm sure it's a winner. You can tell. Steffi said, are we going to scratch it? Tommy said, no, we're going to hold on to it just in case. Stephanie said, just in case what? In case we need the money? Tommy said, no, we don't need the money. We'll never need the money in case we need him. But Grandpa, said Tommy, now this is a long time ago. He's remembering this part from a long time ago. To be honest, he's not even sure this part happened. When he remembers it, it seems like a dream to him. Maybe he imagined it. But this is the way he remembers it. But Grandpa, he says, it's just a dream. And his grandfather says, now you've got it. Now you understand. It's just a dream. It's nothing at all. And in the dream, I'm still here. I'm still with you. I may seem to be gone, but I've only gone on a little trip. Whatever I was once, I am still. And all the little jokes I played, I'm going to play them still. When you see a penny, you must pick it up for me. Save all the ones that are heads up in the little jar the way we do. And tonight, when you're falling asleep, I want you to think very hard. Because tomorrow, when you wake up, I want you to tell me exactly what you'd do if you had $1 million. I want you to tell me your heart's desire. That's all the time we have for today's show. Before we go, I want to thank our special musical guests, John Sheard, Dennis Pendreth, Danny Michelle, Bob King, and Dalla. Thanks also this week to Bill Herault, Brad Scrutt, and Ron Skinner for the technical assistance. David Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is the long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean, and I'd like to invite Dalla up here for one last song. So long for now, from Winkler, Manitoba.
Please sing along, because we know you know the words.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.